Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
When you hear that familiar, hopefully not too annoying music, you know it is time for yet another episode of Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. Thanks so much for being here. This week, I'm going to be answering listener questions. If you have a question, showbiz related, or actually a question about anything, just email me at hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. And every couple of months, I will devote an episode to answering some of your questions. It's kind of a holdover from what I used to do in my blog, Friday Questions. And it was a very popular feature, so I'm extending it here to the podcast. Okay, let's start off. Jim Hopkins has the first question. He says he was watching the opening credits on TBS of a 2020 episode of Young Sheldon, and it was called Body Glitter Something Something. Okay. He said, I counted 15 or 16 different producers and around 8 writing credits. How is this possible? Is this a fairly new thing? I recall something you've mentioned in the past about expanded staffs and split credits, but this listing seemed outlandish, unworkable, unimaginable. Are there some sort of honorary titles, or if real, what does each one actually do? How much can each one earn? Well, I can't really answer that question. Gone with the Wind or Cheers did not have 24 producer writers. Seems like a crazy number. And it is. The only thing is that it means more writers are working, so I think that's a good thing. But yes, earlier in television, there were smaller staffs. When I was on MASH, we had a staff of only 4. The first season of Cheers, the staff was only 4. It was me, my partner David Isaacs, and Glenn and Les Charles. But in those days, you would rely a lot on freelance writers. And they would come in and they would write episodes for your show, and they would write episodes for series all around town. You could actually make a living as a freelance writer. But it got to the point where if you found a writer who did a good job on your show, you didn't want to let him get away and go off and do other shows. So you would feed him more scripts, and eventually you would bring him on staff to help groom him along. And over time, especially with a hit show where the budgets increased and where a lot of times the original creator showrunners after 5-6 years wanted to step away a little bit and not work 19-hour days for 9 months a year. So there was a whole process of grooming writers, and the staffs just grew and grew and grew. And by the final year of Cheers, there probably were 24 writers. You had to get there early to get a spot at the table. It was really kind of ridiculous. It's almost like I'd go in the room and I like, who's she? Who's that person? But yeah, the credits. Usually a writer would get a bump in pay and would get a better credit as they moved up the ladder. And it usually started with staff writers. In many cases, you didn't receive any credit for your first staff job. For me and David, our first staff job on the Tony Randall Show — the Tony Randall Show will come up later in this podcast with another question — but we didn't even get credit we got credit for the episodes we wrote, but we never got a screen credit. And then you move up and you're story editor. And then they got to bump you up to like executive story editor or executive script consultant. And eventually you get bumped up to producer. But there are, as you say, a room full of writers. So all of a sudden, you don't just have one producer, you have five or six or seven. And it depends on seniority. So you could start out as a co-producer, and then you're a producer the following year, and then you're a supervising producer, and a co-supervising producer, and a co-executive producer, and an executive producer. You just keep moving up in titles. And yeah, when you have a big staff, and they've all been there a while, because today there's not as much hopping around from show to show because there are not that many shows. So if you land on a big hit show like Young Sheldon, you're not going to just bail after a year or two. You're going to stick it out as long as you possibly can. And as a result, after year two or three, there's 17 people with producer credits. I think now the TV Academy, and I know the Motion Picture Academy does this too, where there's like only a limited number of producers who are eligible for an Emmy. So if a show wins and 17 people come up on stage, all 17 don't receive Emmys, only the four or five producers that are actually eligible will receive the Emmy. And so that's how that works. And like I said, it's okay by me because there's a lot more writers who actually get a chance to work. Bob Silva from Maui has a question. He says, are two-part episodes specifically written to be two parts, or is it a one-part episode that has enough story to make two episodes? Actually, it's really more the latter. Yes, sometimes, especially if you know there's going to be like a big event, like, say, Goodbye Radar. And we knew that was going to be a big event, and CBS was going to promote it as part of Sweeps Week. And so they specifically wanted a two-parter. But a lot of times, you will start out with a one-parter, and you will be plotting out the story, and it's just going, well, we need this scene, and we need this scene. And eventually, you say, let's make it a two-parter. And it's always hard to find stories. So if you have a story that becomes a two-parter, man, that's fantastic. That's bonus. And it's a great bonus for the writer because all of a sudden he has two script assignments instead of just one. But here's what I have found to be the case more often than not. Two-parters tend to be part and a halfers. And by that, I mean, you plot out the story, and it's basically 45 minutes, not an hour. And so you have some fill in there, generally in part one, so that it fills out the two-parter. But rarely will you have a two-parter that just clicks along where an awful lot happens. You find two-parters tend to be padded from time to time. Next question. John Schrank, S-C-H-R-A-N-K. I hope I pronounced that name correctly. He says, why do you think Neil Simon is becoming forgotten today? Wasn't that long ago that just the name meant Broadway comedy? Well, I don't think he has been forgotten. Certainly not among community and regional theaters. In fact, I would imagine that there is not a single weekend in America where at least one, probably four, Neil Simon plays aren't being produced. You'll see The Odd Couple in Boise, and you'll see Last of the Red Hot Lovers somewhere, and Barefoot in the Park in Camarillo. And I mean, all of his plays seem to continue to have a life of their own. And partly that's because community and regional theaters, their audiences tend to like things that are familiar. And Neil Simon is familiar. Some of the stuff, I have to say, is dated. I love Barefoot in the Park, and that's one of his earliest plays. In fact, that's only his second play. So we're talking now like 1962. So we're talking 60 years ago, and theaters are still putting this thing on. And now when you see it, a lot of it just seems very dated and very creaky. But here's the thing I will say about Neil Simon on Broadway. And that is, about a year ago or so, they did a revival of Plaza Suite. And I think it was Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker. And the reviews were basically scathing, basically saying, God, this is just so dated and old and musty. And the reviews were terrible. It kicked ass. Standing ovations, sellouts every night. It was a huge hit. The reason? People wanted to see Neil Simon. They still want to see Neil Simon. There is very little comedy on Broadway other than musicals. Not many people are writing Neil Simon-type plays, and that's because at the moment, it doesn't seem to really be in favor. Number two, the Broadway scene, like a lot of the theater scene, is now very woke and very important, and the plays all have to be just so relevant and messagey, and so comedy, which is always sort of dismissed, is dismissed in this case too. So there's not a lot of comedy. But it's interesting that when comedy does play on Broadway, it usually does well because people want to see comedy. Okay, The Play That Goes Wrong did great. And all of the very well-written, very well-reviewed, Tony-nominated dramatic plays, they kind of came and went. Well, The Play That Went Wrong just kept trucking along because, like I said, people do want to see comedies. There's some comedy in musicals, but at this stage, unless you have some major stars or there's some kind of IP associated with it, it's really hard to get a comedy on Broadway, which is too bad. I think the problem started when a lot of shows in the 80s and 90s, a lot of TV shows, like, say, Cheers and Frasier, were sort of done in that Neil Simon style, and playwrights were moving out to L.A., saying, I'm going to write a play, and maybe it'll be off Broadway, and maybe I'll make a couple $1,000s, or I can go to L.A., and I can become a writer on Frasier and make tons of money and have my show seen by 30 million people and get residuals when it goes into reruns. So I think there was kind of a mass exodus west. And as a result, there were not a lot of true comedy playwrights that stayed back. Guys like Christopher Durang, who continue to write brilliant comedies for the stage. And I hope Neil Simon plays continue. If you are a young playwright or a young TV writer who wants to get into sitcoms, yeah, some of the stuff is dated. A lot of the stuff is dated, but also a lot of the stuff is very funny. And it's also a master class in being able to write comedy based on character, based on attitude, and lines that are not just jokes, but lines that are moving the story forward. Nobody did it any better than Neil Simon. And there are books that you can buy that are a compilation of his various plays. I suggest, if you're a serious student of comedy, I suggest that you read some of those books. Also, his autobiography has two volumes of his autobiography. The first volume especially is terrific. Read Neil Simon's autobiography, and you'll learn a lot about comedy. Jesse Jackson writes, now my question. As someone who loves music, who haven't you seen perform live that you wish you could have seen perform? Either because they are now moved on to the next plane, I guess he means they're dead, or because they no longer tour. Well, for me, certainly tops on my list, you know, I'm okay boomer, is the Beatles. And when the Beatles did play in 1964 and 1965 at the Hollywood Bowl, and tickets were like $5. The problem was I was too young to drive. And so my mom would have had to like pick me up in front of the Hollywood Bowl. And my mom was not about to fight that kind of traffic to find me and pick me up at the Hollywood Bowl so that I could see the Beatles. So I never did get a chance to see the Beatles. I never got a chance to see Elvis, but I wanted to see the young Elvis, at the old fat Elvis from Vegas, the old guy just sweating and gasping his way through songs. No, that was not of any interest to me, but to see the young, dynamic Elvis Presley of the late 50s, that would have been great. I would have loved to have seen Sinatra in his prime in the 1950s. I did see Sinatra, but by that time, he was well into his 70s. He couldn't hit a lot of notes. He had to have teleprompters because he forgot the words. And so it's the bucket list thing where you go, okay, I've seen Sinatra. But nah, I never got a chance to see the real Sinatra. And there's talk of back in the 40s and 50s, he would be on like a dinner boat with friends. Somebody had a yacht, and they would just cruise around Santa Monica Bay, and he would just sing for everybody on the ship for like 3-4 hours. And all of the other boats in the area would gravitate around this yacht. Imagine just sitting on a yacht on a warm summer evening, just having a drink, and there's Frank Sinatra doing a concert for you. And I mean the good Frank Sinatra from the 1950s when he really had a voice. So I would have liked to have seen Francis Albert in his prime. I would have loved to have seen Queen and Freddie Mercury. I just think that guy is one of the most phenomenal singers of all time. God, what a voice. Never got a chance to see him. Never got a chance to see Elton John, and I would have liked to have seen Elton John because he put on such a great show. And also, he's now gone. I'm looking at these guys, and you know, with the exception of a couple of Beatles, they're all gone, and some of the members of Queen are still around. But Jackie Wilson, I would have loved to have seen Jackie Wilson in his prime. I've been very lucky in that I've seen a lot of great people. I've seen Barbra Streisand. I've seen James Taylor many times. I've seen Simon and Garfunkel. Bette Midler put on a great show. So in that regard, I've been very lucky. David Levinson has a question. He said, you've had three interesting careers in radio as baseball broadcaster and TV writer-director. If you were at the beginning of your career, knew what you know now, but had to pick just one, what would it have been? And I guess the answer to that is writer. I just always considered myself a writer. And even when I was doing baseball my first year with the Baltimore Orioles, I kept a journal, which became a book. It's Gone, No Wait a Minute, which unfortunately was my signature home run call in the minor leagues. So I just always considered myself a writer. I did a blog for 16 years. I'm writing plays now. It's kind of who I am. But if you ask me the question, what job is the most fun? Hands down, baseball announcer. Oh, God, yeah. Being a baseball announcer is truly a hoot. Roger Green said, would you happen to know why, how the Tony Randall Show, told you it would be coming back, moved from ABC to CBS? If so, did anyone indicate how standards and practices at all differed between the networks? Standards and practices were pretty much the same at that time between all of the networks. So why would I answer a question about a show that probably 95% of you have never heard or certainly seen, the Tony Randall Show, which was a show done at MTM. I think it premiered on ABC in 1976, in the fall of 76. And I answer this question for a couple of reasons. Number one, that was our first staff job, as I mentioned, so I was actively involved in the Tony Randall Show. And the other thing is the reason why it moved. It spent its first year on ABC, and we had a full commitment of 22 or 24 shows. And at the end of that year, we were on the bubble. And ABC said, we'll bring you back for the second year, but we'll only give you 13. And CBS came along and said, we'll give you 22. And so Grant Tinker, who ran MTM, decided, well, let's go to CBS. Let's get 22 instead of 13 with the possibility of getting picked up for the back nine and on and on. And Grant later was quoted as saying he thought he made a mistake there. He should have just stayed at ABC, let the show build. It moved to CBS. The audience didn't really know. It wasn't heavily promoted at CBS. And after 1 year on CBS, the show failed. You know, Tony Randall had been on ABC all those years with The Odd Couple. So he was an ABC guy. He was an ABC star. Their audience really knew and appreciated Tony Randall. So here's the point, though, that I want to bring out. Like I said, we were on the bubble. We were getting a 30 share. A 30 share. Now, the other shows that we were up against, and there were only two more networks, we're getting like a 31 share and a 35 share. But still, think about it. A 30 share. The Academy Awards don't get a 30. Don't come close to a 30 share. You know what a good share is on a network show today? A great number. Two. If you get a two share, you get a 2.3 premiere, the network is doing cartwheels. Oh my God, the greatest season premiere in 5 years. 30 share, and we were on the bubble. ABC would only commit to 13 episodes as a result of that. So, times have certainly changed. Brian Kowald, question. I recently finished watching the entire run of Modern Family on Hulu. I can't think of a funnier show in recent times. Did you like Modern Family? What did you think of the writing? Heard anything interesting about the show? Any stories or juicy dish about the show? He said, I actually grew to like the mockumentary format. Maybe I've just grown accustomed to it. I loved Modern Family the first year and a half. I thought it was sparkling. I thought the writing was terrific. The acting, everything about it, I loved. And eventually, over time, they just started repeating themselves. And it just started feeling more and more familiar. And I continued to watch the show, and I continued to enjoy the show, but it really wasn't appointment television anymore. And I have to say, by the last couple of seasons, I got off the train. I just sort of moved on. So interesting things about Modern Family. Well, how about this? I was on it. The first year, I did a voiceover. I was a baseball announcer, and it's early on in the first season. It was probably episode 3 or 4, but the episode begins with that. There's an establishing shot of one of their homes, and over that, you hear me calling a baseball game, and then they go inside to the living room where the family is watching this particular game. But still, you hear my voice in the clear. So I was on Modern Family. In terms of any gossip or dish, very little. It was a very close-knit cast. Everybody seemed to like everybody. Just a lot of really quality people who were on that cast. Ed O'Neill, oh man, you know, Ty Burrell, Julie Bowen, they were all really terrific people. So, no, I don't have any dish about that. I will say, though, that it was done in a very interesting way after a while, because the two creators were Christopher Lloyd and Steve Levitan. And there were creative differences between the two that kind of grew and grew until there was a real fissure between them. And so what they did in later years, and this kind of ties back to the first question about large staffs, is they pretty much split up the season and alternated who was running the show. So Steve Levitan had his whole room of writers, and Christopher Lloyd had his whole room of writers. So there were basically two staffs, and the show, really, from week to week, changed a little bit depending upon whether it was a Chris show or a Steve show. And that's a pretty unusual way of working. But again, it seemed to work out well. And both of those guys are fabulous in their own right. So it's like you would kill to have either Chris or Steve be your showrunner. So to have the two of them was kind of interesting. It's just that the storytelling was a little different between the two shows because they had kind of different philosophies. And the final question is by Richard Bellow, who said, on part 2 episodes of your podcast, you will say, if you didn't listen to the first part, after listening to this, go back and listen to the first part. Why? Why not just go back and listen to the first part first? Well, very simple, because when you get somebody who has taken the time to click on or download your podcast, and you got them, they're listening, the last thing you want to do is say, okay, get off of this and go listen to something else instead. So that's why I do that. And that will do it for this edition of Hollywood and Levine. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, to John Wolfert, Bruce and Jason Miller. You have any questions or anything that you want to discuss with me? Again, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. And please sign up for my Instagram page, because I'm there, and I feature a lot of my cartoons that I sell to The New Yorker and other publications. That is Hollywood and Levine. Got a good interview coming up next week. How's that for a tease? We will talk to you then. Bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
You can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade or at least grab an extra latte after getting a Chime checking account with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, no minimum balance requirements, and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.